You're listening to the Northtown Automotive Extra Point Show with Sal Capaccio. Brought to you by Northtown Automotive. Whatever you're looking for, you'll find it at Northtown. Shop online at northtownauto.com.
All right, back here in the Northtown Automotive Extra Point Show at Niagara Falls Country Club. Porter Cup Media Day today. Going to head out and play some golf in a little while. But in the meantime, we have a media luncheon and press conference to tell us all about the fabulous players that are playing in the Porter Cup this year. I mean, the list of players that has played in this Porter Cup is just amazing. We went through some of them earlier. Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, the famous hole-in-one where Tiger is there. I think there's a plaque there. Brian Colzio sitting next to me here at Niagara Falls Country Club. You've been up here many years watching this, and it's always awesome to see that plaque sitting there from the hole-in-one.
Yeah, we're going to try to go and make that hole-in-one today for ourselves, right? Why not, right?
I've never been. I've always said, I've known, not only have I never had one, I've never been in a group where someone hit one, so today would be a great day.
Yeah, I've seen one in person covering the PGA Championship, but I've never been in a group with one, and I've never had one either, so...
Were you on the hole when the guy, a couple years ago at Oak Hill when it happened?
No, that was the Michael Block.
Yes, Michael Block.
With Rory. The tournament, I'll give you the quick story. 2005, the PGA Championship was in August. It was in New Jersey in Baltusrol. And I actually, it was the hottest week ever that I've ever been at covering these tournaments. It was like 110 real feel on the course or whatever. Anyway, you know. Luckily, us, the media access, I'm able to go into the media tent and cool down with the air conditioning, grab some waters or whatever. So I am going in and I'm like, I want to go watch John Daly play. This is 2005. So Daly's still part of the PGA Championship at this point. I'm going to go walk some holes with Daly. So I literally get two bottles of water, one in each pocket. I'm like, because it's so hot. And of course, I grab an ice cream because, you know, they have it in the media tent. I'm like, got to cool the body down, right, Sal? Take care of yourself. So I go out to watch Daly tee off on one. And as I'm walking down the first hole, because it's 110 whatever out, I'm making a mess of myself with this ice cream. It's like running down. I'm like, all right, I'm supposed to look together here. I'm like a media member here walking, covering this tournament here. So I'm like, well, there's a concession stand halfway down the first hole. So I'm like, I'll stop there. I'll get some napkins. I'll clean up here or whatever. Well, the fourth tee box happened to be right there. So I'm like, I'll watch this group tee off on four, and then I'll go catch up with Daly's group again. Charles Howell III, who has, you know, a longtime journeyman on the PGA Tour, was the first to tee off, and he made a hole-in-one right on the spot right there. So I always say the fact that I actually was a little messy with the ice cream is what caused me to see that hole-in-one. Because if I didn't have to stop and clean my hands off a little, I wouldn't have seen it. Yeah, he made the hole-in-one, like two skips, it went right in. It's the only one I've seen, but it was in the 05 PGA Championship, and the place went bonkers. It was awesome, and that's the only one. But hopefully maybe today in our group we'll have...
I know I've asked you this. Have you ever had one?
Never. I've never had one.
So. You've never played in a group that someone had one?
No.
So I know, and I here's the story. The only one I've really seen was kind of not really seen. So I said I never really seen one. I was on a tee box with my buddies in Florida, and we were about to tee off, and then we heard a thump behind us at another green, and we heard someone yell, "Get in the hole," and we all turned, and it rolled in, and then this woman who had to be probably 65 years old walked up, and it was her who had hit it. And we're all going crazy. And then I looked at her and I said, you know what that means, right? You got to buy the drinks.
Yep, absolutely. What's great about hole-in-one stories is that you're right. You have it like that. It can be so random at any moment. And you don't have to necessarily be like a pro golfer to get a hole-in-one. All it takes is one great shot. And that's what we all love about golf, right? You have that one great shot per round that we always say brings you back to want to play again. And, you know, you can just have that moment where the stars align and the cups. I've definitely had moments where my ball has landed, like, you can see, like, where the old cup was. Like, where, oh, geez, if this was 2 days ago, it was in the hole kind of thing. But, no, I've never had one. So maybe today is our lucky day.
It's funny you say that about coming back. So I'll tell you the personal story later. But the quick story is, yesterday, on the very last hole at Oakdale, I had one of the greatest shots I've ever had in my life. And it was our last hole. And I said, yep. Now I'm really excited to play tomorrow.
Because that's what happens.
Yeah. No, that's what's so great about golf is that it's the hardest sport in the sense, like, tell me what other sport can you be off by like a quarter of an inch with something and it have so much effect. Yeah. You know, I mean, this to take away from no other sport, but if I'm shooting a hockey puck and I'm off by a quarter of an inch, it can still go in. If Josh Allen's throwing to Keon Coleman and he's off by a half an inch, it still can be perfect. In basketball, it can still go in the net. In golf, that can be the difference between the fairway and out of bounds. Like, it's just, it's so difficult. And there is no opportunity for your teammate to help you out in golf either. If, you know, if I'm passing to you in hockey and I'm a little off, well, you can adjust how you take the pass in so it can still be okay.
You shoot in basketball, it could be a rebounder. It says, all right, I'll get up there and tip it in if it rolls off the rim a little bit.
Right. So in golf, when you hit a bad shot, like, there's nobody there to help you and you've got to react. And it's so mentally, to me, challenging. That's the part of it I just love so much, because you are constantly being mentally tested, because it's even decision making beyond the fact of the physical act of swinging, we know is so difficult, and such a little difference can make such a big impact. The fact that, like, mentally now, what kind of shot am I going to hit here? And it's very cliche to say, but I think it's always important. Like, the most important shot is your shot after a bad one. Like, what do you do then? And I think part of it is just, I've gained that perspective as I've gotten older, that, like, okay, take your medicine kind of mentality, but keep par in play, or whatever your goal is. If your goal is to play bogey golf, keep bogey in play, or whatever it is, trying to hit that hero shot. Sometimes there's the opportunity to do so, but sometimes being smart after you hit a poor shot is next. And I'll quote Roger Federer here. I was listening to a commencement speech from him from a few years ago. I thought it was amazing. I've shared it with my tennis players, but I think it works great for golf too. He said, you know, arguably the best, you know, Federer, the best player ever. He's won 81% of his matches in his professional career against the best in the world, but he's only won 54% of the points within. And he said, the professionals and the best in the world of their craft understand that they're going to lose, that they're going to lose points. And, like, how do you then let that go? And how do you play on mentally? He said, like, that's what separates the elites from all the other greats. And I think you could probably use that mentality with any sport. You know, if you're a defensive back, you get beat. Well, how do you handle it the rest of the game? You're a quarterback, you throw an interception. How do you handle it the best of the game? You're a goalie, you let in a goal. You know you're going to let in a goal. Like, how do you handle that? And I thought that, you know, for Federer saying, he's like, look, I barely won more than half the points, 54% of my points in my career. He goes, letting go and understanding you're going to lose. How do the greats deal with how to lose? In golf, when you hit a bad shot, you're going to hit a bad shot. Like, how do you deal with it? I think, like, it's a great message, I think, for all of us, no matter what sport we're playing.
No doubt. Brian Kozo here on the Northtown Automotive Extra Point Show. He's not on the Western Hotline. He's sitting right next to me because we are going to be covering the media portion of Porter Cup today. The tournament is next week. You've been coming out here for many years. I just had Marty on a little while ago and just talking about just how incredible this tournament is from a standpoint of the greatest amateurs really in the world that come right here on Niagara Falls is pretty special.
Yeah, I mean, you had it earlier. I mean, if you can put Tiger Woods on a resume of your tournament, then you know you got something special. And for Phil Mickelson to be here, who's probably in that next breath after Tiger, and Mickelson has won it, by the way, you know, so, I mean, former number one David Duval from the 90s. So, you know, if you're a little older, our age, you know who David Duval is. He played in this event and won this tournament. So the current players, as we mentioned, Justin Thomas, Dustin Johnson, Brooks Koepka, Ricky Fowler, you know, there's quite a few even current names now here that are playing that have done such a good job. I think what's cool about it with the fact that you are now seeing amateur golfers be better at a younger age. So now you're starting to see college freshmen, college sophomores that are maybe have their chance to play in an event like this and win. And that gets them eligible for another big amateur tournament somewhere else, which ultimately leads them to maybe, you know, does that maybe allow them to transfer to a different school or a bigger school or this opportunity? And that's kind of how they are able to maybe start to align themselves for the pathway to what ultimately is probably their goal, which is a professional career. So, you know, you're going to see some players next week up here that are highly ranked on their golf schools, you know, whether it's some of the big power, like SEC schools. We know there's guys that come here from Florida all the time. I know Marty mentioned Billy Horschel has played here many times. Dudley Hart, Buffalo native, professional golfer, has had a great career. He's one of the Florida golf coaches. So he also kind of encourages his kids to come up and participate in this. So you're going to see John Daly's, we mentioned him. I just mentioned him with my story. John Daly's kid from Arkansas had been playing in this the last couple of years. Trevor Immelman, who has played in the International Junior Masters, by the way, East Aurora, played in the of real Masters and won it. Now, of course, the lead analyst on CBS golf coverage. His son was playing in this last year, and Trevor was actually here walking around one of the days. So you never know that next great star is going to be here. And, you know, right now, you may not recognize a lot of these names because they are playing at the amateur level. Most of them will be from the college ranks. There are just amateurs that maybe are just not professional golfers that are playing in this too. But the majority of these players are kind of in their college age time period here, and we may see them, you know, playing in the Corn Ferry Events Tour. I know he mentioned Anthony DeLaSante from Sanborn. Great kid and, you know, got a really, really great college career at Valparaiso where he's been playing. We've been kind of following him a lot on Tee to Green. The best amateur Western New York player here in quite some time, Sal, that I think really has a chance to make it, you know, in terms of being a professional golfer. So I'm excited to see him compete this week. I would put him right up there with any of these players this week with a chance to maybe win this event.
We haven't really chatted since the U.S. Open ended in Oakmont. What did you think about the finish and J.J. Spaun and his run?
Yeah, pretty wild. I mean, that's what's so great. Again, takes that one moment. Spaun, who was in contention for the first few days, kind of fell back. And then you had that rain delay, and we kind of maybe even forgot about him. Sam Burns was playing well. Hovland was at the top. Adam Scott was at the top. But Spaun, I loved his mentality. You know, kind of we just talked a little bit about mentality. He said it was the rain delay, the weather delay was like a reset for him. And he said he kind of was thinking about, you know, what people were telling, hey, Tiger Woods would still be grinding on this and he still would not be giving up and he would still think he has a chance to win. And he kind of took that mentality out there and then played very well and very steady. I mean, what a moment on that 18th green to have that long putt, that 60-foot plus putt go in for him. And him and his caddy celebrate and the crowd goes wild. Like, I mean, that's a historical moment in U.S. Open history, but for him, it's a life and career changing win for him, no doubt. And now Spaun's going to be in the Ryder Cup. He's going to be exempt for all the majors. I mean, so like, you know, his life has now changed because of that week, but yeah, pretty wild. We've had 2 years in a row now where the U.S. Open's been phenomenal. Last year, it was all about the star power. It was DeChambeau and McIlroy back and forth down the stretch. And, you know, DeChambeau hitting that incredible bunker shot on 18 to get up and down to beat McIlroy by one. And, you know, at the time, the huge storyline, Rory blows it again. Well, we know Rory went on to win the Masters and been interesting since then. But for Spaun, even though maybe he's not necessarily what you put in the star power level, it was a great storyline there too. And there were probably moments, Sal, within the final hour of that U.S. Open that you could have argued six different guys winning. And, you know, obviously this was the storyline that we got, and it was a pretty incredible one.
No doubt about it. And, of course, we're going to have hopefully a couple more storylines coming up next week right here at the Porter Cup. The hole we were talking about, though, it was 14, Marty? Is that where Tiger had his hole? 12. You played the hole, right? Tell me a little bit about hole 12.
Well, it's a par 3, and, Marty, that's the one the creek kind of runs. Yeah, kind of like to the left of it. It's not necessarily like parallel to the tee box, but it kind of – it runs a little diagonally, and it comes more into play as you hit your shot a little bit deeper. But bunker on the other side, and yeah, when we go out there today, we'll try and see if we can replicate what Tiger did for sure. Yeah, I mean, that's what's so great. All these par threes, you got the chance of it going in. The par threes here at this course are great. For those that maybe if you come up next week and you walk the course, the par threes are all different. They're all unique. The one that you play early on, I think number 6, just it's super short. I mean, we're going to play it 7. I'm sorry, 7. We're going to play it today, and it is a really short one. Like, we're going to be hitting some sort of wedge probably into this green, but there are bunkers surrounding it everywhere. So, and the pin placement can be in a really, really difficult, challenging spot. And then there's one on the back nine, number 16, where I know you said you can see Toronto here. We might be able to see it from out there too, from some of the openings that they've cleared out. A really, really fun section. If you're going to come up next week and spectate, a great spot to go watch next week here at Niagara Falls Country Club, if you haven't been here, is the 15, 16, 17 area. A lot of good action. 15 is a short par 4 that guys might be going for to try to drive it in one, maybe have an opportunity as an eagle And then 16 is a great par three visually that you can watch, and then you can watch him hit on 17 too. That's a really, really fun spot to watch if you come up here next week. And here's what's great too. I know Marty said free admission, which I think is amazing. Bring your son or daughter. Yeah. Going to a sporting event we know is nothing like it, Sal. You and I do it so much with our son, and we value that time so much. The fact here that you can get right up next to them, I mean, you can get as close. You can hear, you'll hear them breathe and grunt when they swing the golf club. I remember bringing my son up here when he was young, and one of the players tossed him a ball, and he was holds it like it was the greatest thing ever. So, the fact that you don't have to, going to like a major like the PGA Championship at Oak Hill is amazing, but it's hard to bring a little kid. If you have a little kid and you want to, and they're into golf, or you want to get them excited about golf, bringing them up here is great because they can be right up front. They can be within 5 feet of the player hitting. So that's what's really cool. And now that they've added the women's division too, if you have a daughter, like, have them come up here. The players are always so good with interacting with the kids from what I've seen. So the fact that it's free, obviously a short drive from everybody here in Western New York, like, I would definitely encourage it.
Brian Colzio, also the Buffalo Sabres pregame and postgame host. Obviously the Sabres have made a significant move in the offseason. They've traded J.J. Paterka. We're awaiting a secondary move, but we don't know if that's going to happen with Bo Byram. But now they're going to go to arbitration with Bo Byram, which means he can't have an offer sheet given to him by another club. But it doesn't mean the Sabres can't trade him. Are you anticipating him being traded?
I mean, we've had so many like mixed signals with Byram. Like, well, they're going to look to trade him. Well, they don't want to sign him long term. Now, of course, the fact that maybe the offer sheet piece is off the table. It's interesting that it was a team decision, because Adams spent a lot of his press conference talking about like the salary cap and the space that they're leaving was for Byram. Well, in case of an offer sheet. Well, then he's saying they're going to match it. Well, if ultimately you were going to match an offer sheet, like, why wouldn't you want to have gotten things done before it even got to that point where you were going to be forced to make that decision? I mean, we look back at how the Drury-Briere situation went down. Had the Sabres handled those two contracts differently, maybe Thomas Vanek's decision goes down differently. But Darcy Regier at the time, and I think probably the right thing so, is that you had to match it, because you're like, well, we can't lose Drury and Briere and now Vanek, even though it was going to be a boatload of picks, coming back from Edmonton. So right now, I think you look and say, well, if we got an offer sheet, we would have had to have matched it. Probably so, because you don't want to lose them. Right now, Kevin Adams, I think, should not be dealing with any more move or any trade or any transaction that involves futures, as they say, draft picks, prospects.
I agree.
Yeah, because he may not be here to see any of those.
To me, it's, and I know people made the point on social media with me when I said this, that, well, it's not the same pipeline they've had. It's not as good. It doesn't matter to me. I don't care. I'm not interested in another first or second round pick that we have to wait 3 years to see, just to even have a chance for that person to develop. Like, you got to get NHL players at some point.
I agree. And here's what we've seen with the Sabres recently. If you look at the last handful of major trades that has involved what we would label as an upper tier player, it's always been the Sabres trading that upper tier, but like the best player in the trade has left Buffalo. You look at the Eichel trade. Now, Alex Tuch's been really good, and I hope that the Sabres work something out. I think he's excellent to have in this organization. But it's not an insult to Alex Tuch. Jack Eichel is still the best player in that trade. Sam Reinhart, the Sabres got picks and draft picks and might end up with a star goalie in Devon Levi as a part of that trade. But the best player in that trade left Buffalo in Sam Reinhart. At the time, you go years ago, Ryan O'Reilly, at the time, he was the best player in that trade. Now, that trade, you could argue, worked out because it turned into Tage Thompson, who obviously now has turned himself into an elite scorer in the NHL. But at the time, the best player in that trade was leaving Buffalo. Even just recently, J.J. Paterka, the best player in that trade. I think Kesselring is going to be very good for this team and a very hopeful good partner for Owen Power. But in the moment, right now, on paper, the best player in that trade is leaving Buffalo. And where is that return coming back? The Sabres do maybe have prospects. They maybe do have extra draft picks that they can deal with. They might even have some depth with, players in Rochester or in the collegiate ranks that they own the ownership to their draft status already that they could move. But where's the reverse trade? And that's the one that I feel like Kevin Adams, and I thought, if we hear all these NHL insiders have been saying the Sabres are open to making a big move. The big move that I'm looking for is not the best player in the trade leaving Buffalo. I'm like, where's the best player in the trade coming to Buffalo? And I understand no trade clauses and all these sort of things that Kevin Adams has brought up, I think are fair to bring up, but fans are tired of hearing excuses. They just want to see something done at this point. Like, where is that trade where the best player in the trade actually comes back to Buffalo? And that's the one that I feel like we're still sitting here waiting for. If Bo Byram gets traded, is he going to be the best player in that trade? And there's, you know, a thought that maybe we can just add that to the list, unfortunately. You'd hope maybe. Now, can Byram plus number one draft pick plus prospect maybe land you a great player elsewhere? That's ultimately what would be a trade that I feel like I'd be on board with.
Yeah, but you go back to, again, these guys, if you want that type of player, they might have a no-movement clause, might have a no-trade clause. I saw the other day that people talked about Rossi, right, in Minnesota, and he had apparently his no-trade clause kicked in on July 1st this year. So if you're going to trade for him, it had to be before July 1st, because otherwise, why would he say, oh, yeah, sure, I'll just go to Buffalo.
Right, and you have this, where we've heard it before with other moves that Adams has said potentially has been made, and the player squashes it by saying he's not going to come here. And here again is the chicken or the egg argument. Like, well, if you can't get players to play here, how are you going to get them to be better? Adams is dealing from maybe a position of weakness, but unfortunately, he's been a part of the reason that this team hasn't been able to get it done. I mean, everybody, whether it's Adams, the coaches that have been here through his tenure, to miss the playoffs 5 years in a row in the NHL and get a sixth season, if I'm Adams, I'm feeling extremely fortunate. And, you know, everybody's rooting for him to be successful. They want this team to snap the streak. But I'm surprised that he hasn't still been more aggressive in trying to do things. Even something like a signing, I was mentioning this with Joe yesterday, Nikolaj Ehlers signs with Carolina. Now, maybe again, Ehlers would have wanted absolutely nothing to do with the Sabres. But a player that's maybe second tier, not Mitch Marner level, maybe second tier, like Ehlers, he signed for $8 million there. Well, maybe you're going to have to give 9.5 or 10, and they have the space to do it. And then Adams has said, well, we have to keep this space just in case of the offer sheet for Byram. See, and that to me seems like reactive. Like, you've got to go ahead and make a statement that you can get a player here. And I think fans would understand if we looked at a contract and Ehlers maybe got 9.5 or $10 million. We're like, ooh, that's kind of high for him. But I think that's what the Sabres have to do right now. They're in a spot where I think they're going to have to overpay to maybe get a big name or give up something that maybe even the trade, you might say, maybe that doesn't favor the Sabres. But if it gets a bigger name here that ultimately maybe can push you over the top, I think you have to do it. And because I feel like Adams is running his timetable for him being the GM, to me, I feel like it's ticking and it could be done at any moment. I think I'm surprised that he hasn't been more aggressive. And he might immediately respond to me and saying, I've been trying. I just can't get those no-movement clauses. I can't get this other team to agree to him. At some point, though, I feel like you have to pull the trigger. Because ultimately, you look on paper at their roster, tell me how they're different. They lost a top six forward who's capable of scoring 30 goals. They've added a defenseman that I feel like will be good, maybe on their second pair with Owen Power. But are they actually better than they were a year ago? If I look up and down the roster, they said they're harder to play against. And he said, well, that's going to be ultimately the difference that maybe pushes them in. I mean, they missed the playoffs by 12 points. Like, is being harder to play against with your second pair D, one of them, and maybe your third and fourth liner being a little bit more tougher to play against? Is Jack Quinn all of a sudden going to score 30 this year? Like, he's banking on a lot of things that ultimately you're hoping is Yuri Kulik going to take another step. I mean, these are all the things that I feel like is fair to criticize Adams for when they missed the playoffs by one, when they had 91 points and Florida had 92, and he was kind of saying, well, they all had great years. They're just going to take the next step kind of thing, and then that'll be enough. And ultimately, we're shown that for many of them, they took a step backwards. So
it's so funny you bring up the 12 points, and then I go right to all they had to do, Brian, was get 45% of that losing streak, the points, right? Like, they 13-game winless streak.
27 I mean, points up for grabs.
Yeah, if you would have gotten 13 points, half the points, you're in the playoffs.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what they look at and go, that's how close we are. Well, we don't look at it that way, but I wouldn't doubt if they're in their own offices going, look, it, there's 13 games here. That's how close we are. We may not be close on the 12-point gap, but really, it was 13 games where if we just get half those points, we're in the playoffs.
Right. And that streak didn't ultimately start with that Colorado game. I think it was the third game in or the fourth game in, but that game, remember, they were up 4-0 after.
Oh, I remember. It was a It was Max's birthday party. We were there in the arena, and they were having a great time. The kids were, it's 4-0, let's go, baby, and then everything fell apart.
Yeah, and that obviously really mentally crushed them for a while. They could not recover from that. Because the three previous losses before that were what you'd call, quote, good losses. Like, it was an overtime loss. They were, I think one of the, I think the first one was a 1-0 loss to Minnesota, where you had a great performance from Lukanen, and they didn't ultimately score. So it wasn't like it was trending that way into the Colorado game, but boy, that game crushed them. And then for the next 2 weeks, it was like they were just lost. It took them too long to recover, and ultimately that was different. And you mentioned getting some of those points. Just had you gone 4-9 even in that stretch, well, maybe at trade deadline time now, you're in a different spot. And now maybe the trades that they make or the moves they had to make are different. And maybe that affects them in terms of the moves they make now. Or maybe that one or two moves that, you know what, Kevin Adams thing, I am going to be a little bit more aggressive now and swing for the fences here on a trade at the trade deadline. Whereas at the trade deadline, it was more about, again, building for the future because we knew they were so far out of it at that point.
I have a goaltending question for you. Can you stick around for a minute? Yeah. Are you okay? You can stick for the break? Okay. Brian Colesio, I want to ask you about Levi and UPL and how they should play this going forward. Brian Colesio is with me here. Sal Capaccio at Niagara Falls Country Club. It is Porter Cup Media Day today. We're having a great time not only talking about the Porter Cup, of course, the Buffalo Sabres. And of course, since Brian's sticking around, I'll ask him a little bit about Bill's training camp, what he's looking forward to coming up as it starts on July 23rd. We'll take a timeout right now here on the at Niagara Falls Country Club on the Northtown Automotive Extra Point Show.